What next steps would you recommend?
Well, you know, we need to be rallying all over the country, and we need to be standing up, and we need to be very loud to insist that religion should be a cause for celebration, not discrimination, a cause for liberation, not subjugation, a cause for a bridge, not a bludgeon. And we have to say, just because this law is now the law, doesn't mean it's moral. And we have to stand up and say, if you're doing this, you are not representing a good religion, you're representing bad religion. It's very important that everyone stand up and be very clear about where they stand on this law.
Reverend Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch, we thank you so much for being with us, joining us from Massachusetts, President and CEO of Interfaith Alliance. And that does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our website is democracynow.org. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, I'm Jill Fritz with the Humane Society of the United States. And you're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is conducting a survey, and we want to hear from you. Your valuable feedback about KBOO will help shape the types of music, news, and public affairs programming we bring you and our community in the years ahead. We're also interested in how you listen to KBOO. And we'll use this feedback to help serve you better. The survey is anonymous. However, you will have an opportunity to provide your contact information to enter a drawing. 10 lucky winners will receive a $50 gift card. The survey is open now, and the deadline to participate is Sunday, July 16th. Go to our website at kboo.fm/survey23. kboo.fm/survey23. Thank you in advance for your time and your feedback. It will help KBOO serve you and our community in the months and years ahead. Stay tuned for the next strategic plan coming soon.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, firefighting efforts have doubled at the Tunnel 5 fire near White Salmon, Washington.
Oregon natural resource workers face threats on the job, according to a new survey.
And in international news, Monday was the hottest day on record for the globe.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, July 5th, 2023. I'm Ron Bronson.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. The Tunnel 5 fire continues westward, putting nearly 1,000 Skamania County residents under evacuation orders. The smoke from the fire is headed eastward now, dropping the air quality in areas of Portland. KBOO's Grant Button has more on that story.
The Tunnel 5 wildfire started Sunday near White Salmon, Washington, and according to officials, it was likely caused by humans. The fire is located near Hood River across the Columbia. The wildfire currently spans 546 acres and is only 5% contained, but it hasn't grown much since Tuesday. That's despite nearly 200 firefighters working to contain it with air tankers and helicopters. Tunnel 5 continues to move westward with Level 3 evacuation orders in place for parts of Skamania County. However, the smoke from the fires is moving eastward, causing a drop in air quality for those living to the east of the flames, including areas of Portland. Around 1,000 residents have received evacuation orders so far, according to the Southeast Washington Interagency Incident Management Team. For KBOO News, I'm Grant Button.
It's not just hot in Portland, but all over the world. This past Monday set the record for the hottest day ever recorded, with a global average temperature of 62.60 degrees Fahrenheit. Yesterday, July 4th, the average world temperature rose to 60.92, according to data from the U.S. National Centers for Environmental Prediction. The centers reported, quote, China is experiencing a scorching new heat wave less than 2 weeks after record-breaking temperatures were reached in Beijing. last week saw a dangerous heat dome over Texas and northern Mexico, while the UK baked in its hottest record June on record. Jenny Miller is the executive director of the Global Climate and Health Alliance. Miller said, quote, "People around the world are already enduring climate impacts from heat waves, wildfires, and air pollution to floods and extreme storms," end quote. Yesterday, the World Meteorological Organization confirmed that the El Niño weather pattern has returned, meaning even hotter temperatures are on the way.
On the last day of the 2023 Oregon legislative session, House Bill 3414, a key part of Governor Tina Kotek's priority of increasing housing, failed by one vote. Two Senate Democrats, Chris Gorsuch of Troutdale and Deb Patterson of Salem, voted against it. Initially, the bill would have allowed developers to get fast-track approval of virtually any new housing project. However, an amendment gave protection to environmentally sensitive areas. After Republican senators returned to work in mid-June, Kotek added to the bill a one-time fast-track expansion of urban growth boundaries around the state that would add more developable land. That new amendment led to the Oregon Conservation Network, which includes 42 environmental groups, to label the bill a major threat. After the vote, Kotek tried to get Senator Gorsuch to change his mind, but he refused. However, Kotek isn't giving up, saying, quote, "The topic is not going away. Housing is a crisis," end quote.
Oregon natural resource workers have faced violence and threats on the job, according to a recent survey of field staff from 9 state agencies. Last year, 2 state lands workers were threatened with murder when they told a Lincoln County property owner he was violating a state environmental law. That incident sparked an investigation of the safety of Oregon's natural resource workers, many of whom work in remote areas. A survey of field staff found a series of unpleasant incidents had taken place, ranging from verbal abuse to outright assaults. A third of the more 600 agencies statewide who took the survey said they had a public interaction that made them concerned for their safety. That included dog attacks, threatened with loaded guns and large knives, and shots being fired near them. Numerous women reported regularly experiencing sexual harassment. Some said their state uniforms and marked vehicles made them targets for road rage. Many of the state workers were working in remote areas with little cell service. They want better technology such as satellite phones, GPS monitoring, and body cameras. They even want to carry pepper spray. The survey found that threats got in the way of people doing their jobs and caused job burnout. Oregon Governor Tina Kotek said she, quote, "believes that the results of the survey are deeply concerning and must be addressed with haste," end quote. The governor's office said they're working with the natural resource agencies on policy changes to ensure staff safety.
To Washington State, where food insecurity is rampant, especially among low-income households. Black Washingtonians are the most likely to experience hunger. Eric Tegedoff has more.
3 years on from the start of the pandemic, securing food is one of the biggest challenges facing households in Washington State. The Washington State Food Security Survey, which focuses on low-income households, found about half struggled to afford food. Rising food costs are compounding the problem. Head of the Washington State Feeding Program, Jim Buchanan, started working on the food insecurity issue in Washington while helping people get vaccinated against COVID-19.
Through that, I found there was a great need for food. A lot of people were having issues not being able to eat. A lot of folks' jobs changed or ended, and they were just kind of struggling.
Buchanan has worked with a number of organizations to help fight food insecurity, including King County Equity Now, Mount Zion Baptist Church in Seattle, and Carolyn Downs Family Medical Center. He notes that black people are greatly affected by hunger. The Washington State Food Security Survey found 47% of black Washingtonians were experiencing food insecurity, the highest of any race. Buchanan says even as gentrification has pushed black people out of Seattle, hunger has not let up.
Wherever we go, the problems go also. Of lack of economics, lack of food security, redlining, and not getting proper treatment in housing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Buchanan says resources need to be distributed more equitably to people.
We need clear and critical thinkers to get together and figure out a right system. Apparently, that's not happening on the level that it should. We've got some folks that are working really hard to make sure it happens, and they're doing a great job, but it's not enough.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Oregon nurses continue to bargain with OHSU over their new contract. Some of the main issues at stake include changes to their pension plans, high turnover rates, and the high cost of living in Oregon. KBOO's Grant Button has more on the story.
Nurses at three hospitals in Oregon are looking to overcome impasses in negotiations over their union contracts. Last week, informational pickets took place at the Oregon Health and Science University, or OHSU, in Portland and two partner hospitals in Hillsboro and Astoria. Conditions for nurses have been in the spotlight after a week-long strike by Providence Health System workers in June. Erica Swartz is a nurse at OHSU and says high turnover rates are one of the biggest concerns in their union negotiations.
We are asking the employer to focus on retention, to recognize that retaining nurses is very important to how the hospital functions and to allow us to provide that high-quality patient care.
Swartz says losing nurses also means hospitals lose institutional knowledge. The separate contracts at the three hospitals all expired on June 30th. OHSU did not return a request for comment. Evan Bullinger is an emergency department nurse at the Astoria-based Columbia Memorial Hospital, a partner of OHSU. He says nurses are concerned about a change to their pension plan. They also are battling the high cost of living in the region, which Bullinger says has deterred even higher paid travel nurses.
If travel nurses can't find anything, I don't see how a new grad wanting to work here would be able to.
Swartz says nurses went into the profession to provide high quality care.
We don't want to have days where we barely get by, and we are asking our employer to stand up and be accountable to having the highest standards of care possible and providing the care environment so that our communities and our patients can receive the best care possible.
For KBOO News and the Oregon News Service, I'm Grant Button.
The Oregon Tribal Student Grant Program was allotted $24 million in the most recent state budget. Even though the Tribal Grant Program had hoped for more money, students who received the grant feel that a financial weight has been lifted off their shoulders. KBOO's Harper Simone has more.
A college grant program for tribal students in Oregon received an extension in this year's budget. The Oregon Tribal Student Grant was funded with $24 million. It covers costs for members of the state's nine federally recognized tribes to attend college in Oregon. Sandy Henry is the education director of Cow Creek Band of Umpqua Tribe of Indians. She says the students in her tribe who received the grant last year felt a financial burden was lifted.
This program has opened doors for them, has relieved some of the stress of trying to be a full-time student and a full-time employee and balancing that. This is helping alleviate that.
The program was started last year with $19 million, but became a program with continuous funding in this year's budget. According to the Oregon Higher Education Coordinating Commission, only 45% of Native American students complete a bachelor's degree within 6 years, compared to 68% of all students. Henry says the grant isn't just for the state's major universities.
We do have a tremendous amount of folks that go into trade technical, and we have a fabulous local community college that is emphasizing a lot of the trade technical programs. So the Oregon Tribal Student Grant Program can help with that, help make that happen for our tribal young adults.
Governor Tina Kotek and the Oregon Higher Education Coordinating Commission originally asked for $40 million in funding for the program. For KBOO News and the Oregon News Service, I'm Harper Simone.
You're listening to KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Miles Sibley from Street Roots about his new article covering the hurdles of trans and non-binary Oregonians must jump through to change their name and gender marked on their official documents. At 6 p.m., it's Paradigms. Then at 7, it's the Global Sale. Tonight's weather is clear skies with a low of 65. Tomorrow's weather is sunny skies with a high of 91. Today in history, in 1994, Jeff Bezos founded Amazon, now the biggest e-commerce website in the world. Bezos started Amazon as an online marketplace for books and did not sell other products until 1998. The quote of the day is from Miyamoto Musashi, a Japanese philosopher, strategist, and writer who said, quote, "Think lightly of yourself and deeply of the world."
A new study shows disparities in U.S. maternal mortality rates. The Teamsters reach a tentative deal with UPS to avert a strike, and activists vow to reclaim public education by focusing on school board elections. With more on these stories, it's Catherine Carley with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
For too long, the pain of Black women has been delegitimized. And so the U.S. has the highest rate of maternal mortality in the developed world.
Representative Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts says despite record spending, maternal deaths in the U.S. have more than doubled over the past two decades. A new study finds Black mothers died at the nation's highest rates, while the largest increases in deaths were found in American Indian and Native Alaskan mothers. Experts say the U.S. is not investing enough in public health, mental health, or social services. The findings were published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Teamsters working for shipping giant UPS say they've reached a tentative deal that could lower the chances of a nationwide strike. Teamsters President Sean O'Brien says negotiations continue to increase workers' wages.
The Teamsters will take on corporate America and win historic gains for hundreds of thousands of workers, or UPS will put itself on strike, triggering the largest single employer strike in American history.
UPS has already agreed to end mandatory overtime for drivers and acknowledge more federal holidays. O'Brien calls the negotiations a defining moment for organized labor. Thousands of hotel workers in Southern California have walked off the job, demanding higher pay and better benefits. Unite Here Local 11 President Susan Minato says workers are struggling to survive.
And we are finding that many people live in their cars. Many people have three families to an apartment, a single bedroom or two bedroom apartment.
The union represents up to 15,000 workers at major hotels, which say they will remain open during the strike using non-union staff. The parental rights group Moms for Liberty say it will use its political action committee next year to engage in school board races nationwide. Co-founder Tiffany Justice says it will also endorse state board level and elected superintendents.
We believe that public education is a fundamental value to the United States of America, and we fully intend on reclaiming and reforming public education.
The group has been labeled an extremist organization by the Southern Poverty Law Center for allegedly harassing community members, advancing anti-LGBTQ legislation, and book bans. New data reveal the state of Maine had the highest voter turnout rate in last year's midterm elections, with more than 60% of its voting age population casting ballots. Secretary of State Shayna Bellows credits the state's volunteer poll workers.
Making sure that every Maine citizen who wanted to vote was able to cast their ballot.
Nationwide, turnout fell more than 5 percentage points to roughly 47%. And attorneys general from 10 states plan to sue the EPA, saying its failure to ensure emission standards for residential wood-burning stoves has allowed their continued sales. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
A new partnership aims to help boost the housing supply in rural Alaska. Alaska Natives are some of the hardest hit by the housing shortage. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
Alaska Natives are among the hardest hit by the state's housing shortage. As KMBA's Rhonda McBride reports, rural areas struggle the most.
A new housing trust called Housing Alaskans, a public and private partnership, also known as HAP, hopes to change this. But Preston Simmons, who chairs the board, says it won't be easy.
It was expensive to build up here before, but it's really expensive now.
In the last 40 to 50 years, rural communities haven't seen much new housing. Simmons says that's due in large part to building costs, which can be several times higher than in urban areas. Housing shortages are something Faith Tulick knows all too well. A few years ago, she left Hooper Bay, a remote community on the Bering Sea coast, for more schooling. But when she finished her studies, she decided against moving her family back home.
There'd be no way we could get our own place out there.
Tulick says the best option was to move in with her mother and the rest of her extended family, a household of 10 people packed into a small home, not unusual for Hooper Bay. So Tulick signed up for a Rural Cap self-help building project in South Central Alaska, in which her family and 8 others worked together to build 9 homes with a lot of the cost covered in exchange for their labor. Tulick says she wishes Hooper Bay could have a similar program. And with Hap in the mix, that just might be possible someday.
Alaskans have a lot of great ideas and work really hard.
Simmons says Hap hopes to partner with tribes and other organizations to put those ideas to work and support projects like one it funded in Sitka this year, the Hikasani Project, which means little houses in the Tlingit language. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
When conditions worsened at their school, the Shoshone Paiute tribes mounted a vigorous lobbying campaign at the Nevada legislature. KUNR's Maria Palma reports.
When the legislative session opened this year, the tribes called for funding to replace Oahe Combined School, which serves more than 300 students living on the Duck Valley Indian Reservation. They highlighted problems like a bat infestation and an old heating system. For 4 months, Tribal Chairman Brian Mason encouraged his community to raise their voices and speak out about the bad condition of their school. And it worked. On June 13th, Nevada's governor signed a bill that earmarks $64.5 million to replace the Oahe Combined School. Sean Davis, a sophomore at Oahe Combined School, traveled 6 hours to be present at the ceremonial signing in Carson City.
I'd imagine it bigger and better than our current one right now, and just a whole better place than what we got now.
Diana Conoyer heads the National Indian Education Association. She says this is an example of tribal empowerment.
Oahe tribal leader advocated with the state. Even though a tribal school is on a reservation, it is still a school with students that live within that specified state.
Federal and state funding, as well as philanthropy, are options that tribes can use to improve their schools, she says.
There needs to be a different way of approaching tribal-state partnership.
Mason says it is a big win for the tribe, its students, and future generations.
With so many things challenging them on the reservation, everything is stacked against them. This is going to help.
Mason says the tribes already have set aside 80 acres for a new school. He expects it will take about 2 years to be built. I'm Maria Palma.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The only thing Russia observers can agree on about the Prigozhin mercenary plan is that it weakens Russian President Vladimir Putin. As for the lingering questions raised by the resistance action, we go to global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. Yevgeny Prigozhin's abbreviated march on Moscow is being intensively studied by intelligence officials and Russia experts. About the only point of consensus is that Putin has been weakened. Experts can't even agree on what to call the episode. Mutiny? Coup attempt? Revolt? Insurrection? So there are plenty of lingering questions, which is today's subject. U.S. intelligence reportedly knew in advance that Prigozhin was planning some kind of resistance act. We don't know how it knew, but we are told that a senior Russian general, Sergei Suravikin, was aware of Prigozhin's plans and may even have had an association with the Wagner mercenary group. If true, does it mean that Prigozhin has allies in the top ranks of the Russian military? Or was that general actually loyal to Putin and reported to him on Prigozhin's plans? Some reports say the general is under arrest. Prigozhin easily took over the Russian military base in Rostov-on-Don. How was that possible? What does that event tell us about his support in that area of southern Ukraine? In the course of the Wagner Group's march toward Moscow, Russian air forces attacked it, suffering casualties. Why was there no mobilization by Putin's loyalists after that event? And why was Prigozhin not punished for the killing of several Russian soldiers? Prigozhin's main dispute was with the Russian Defense Ministry and the military leadership in charge of the fighting in Ukraine. He aimed his criticisms at two leaders in particular, Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu and General Valery Gerasimov, Chief of the General Staff. One report suggests that Prigozhin planned to capture both. Will those two officers remain in charge? Will the ministry and chain of command be reorganized? The Russian military's many problems, such as weak supply lines, top-down decision-making, corruption, and unimaginative strategizing, are likely to continue. How will those problems affect the military's morale and effectiveness? Now that Prigozhin and the Wagner troops are based in Belarus, what is their mission? Has Prigozhin been neutralized, or is he still a political and military force? Will Wagner fight again in Ukraine, or will it be reorganized or reassigned, for example, to Africa, where it has committed atrocities? Meantime, small private armies proliferate in Russia. Will Moscow continue to support them as it did Wagner, which Putin said received $1 billion for its services? Then there's Putin's relations with China. He has to be thinking that the Chinese view his response to the revolt with dismay. He allowed a rogue figure to question war strategy rather than have him removed, and then he struck a deal with the man whom he called a traitor. In short, Putin is weak, not at all like Xi Jinping, and therefore something of a liability. An ally who put China in a difficult position by launching a war, and who now shows lack of firm leadership just when it is important that China have a powerful partner in total control when dealing with the West. Can Putin therefore continue to count on China's economic and political support? How can he rectify China's perception of his leadership? The bigger picture, Putin's future. A major setback such as this revolt surely will affect his thinking and behavior in the weeks and months ahead. Will he become more determined than ever to prevail in Ukraine? Is Putin more or less likely to continue to listen to calls for peace talks? Might he decide to pull back in Ukraine in order to consolidate his authority in Moscow? How many heads will roll because of the revolt? Is Prigozhin's life in danger in Belarus? In short, what, if any, lessons has Putin learned from the biggest threat to his tenure? Everyone is talking about Putin's weaknesses, but he did do some things right in response to the uprising. He crafted a deal that would sideline Prigozhin and avoid a bloody battle with Wagner. The mercenary group's power may never be the same. Putin did not declare national emergencies in Moscow and other cities, an action that might have caused mass panic and defections to Prigozhin's side. And Putin seemed to maintain control of Russia's military forces. So perhaps Putin has not been as permanently damaged as many observers assume. Up to now, I've been talking only about how the revolt might affect Putin, but what about his adversaries? What lessons have they drawn? A presumably weakened adversary can be an invitation to press one's advantage, but at the risk of a disproportionate response from an adversary that feels cornered. Will prudence or aggressiveness guide US, NATO, and Ukraine's next moves? Two experts write in Foreign Affairs magazine, quote, "The West has no interest in preserving the Putinist status quo, but neither should it seek a sudden toppling of the Putin regime. For the West, upheaval in Russia may matter mostly for what it signifies in Ukraine, where the potential for instability in Russia may open fresh military options. Apart from exploiting these options in tandem with Kiev, the West can do little more than start bracing itself for instability within and beyond Russia's borders," unquote. Well, we shall see. I'm Mel Gertoff for the Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael, who's glad to be free of Independence Day.
"Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness," the Declaration of Independence said. On the night of July 3rd, in the city of brotherly love, where the Declaration was signed, 5 men were killed and 2 children injured. Do guns bring happiness, a sense of liberty? What if my liberty is an obstacle to your pursuit of happiness? We're the unhinged states of ammunition, more guns than people, the rocket's blood-red glare, bullet bombs bursting in flesh. Our rich white property and slave-owning founders declared all men to be equal, so there's no need for affirmative action or to keep anyone from being born. Who knew that when a supreme being appeared again, it would be a court doing the time warp to simple white and black men and women times? We are free to accept the dissolution of our democracy, aware from childhood how much happiness we can safely pursue. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, July 5th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories, tips, and burning desires at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Dan Raphael, Grant Button, Harper Simone, Mark Ternoy, and the loquacious Mel Gertoff. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Antonia Gonzalez, and Suzanne Potter. The director of Evening News is the affable Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Michelle Coppola.
And I'm Ron Bronson. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO at 44321. Stay tuned now for the KBOO News in depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
This is KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm speaking with Miles Sylvie, Street Roots intern, about his new story titled Trans People Face Fees, Systemic Hurdles When Changing Legal ID. Name and gender changes take months to complete and cost over $500. Welcome to the show, Miles.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. So your new article breaks down what the landscape looks like for trans and non-binary Oregonians who want to change their legal ID, and it's a complicated process. So to start out here, can you give our listeners an overview of what all is required to change your name and gender marker on official documents?
So in Oregon, you generally start out by getting some kind of legal proof of your name change, either by going to court and getting a court order, or there's a slightly different process that people can do if they're doing it for gender identity reasons. And once you have that, you can go in and do the various forms and office visits required for changing driver's license, title and registration, birth certificate, passport. And generally people, once they have the court order, they do social security records first, just so that all of their kind of most important social security related ID lines up, and each process tends to be a series of forms.